Warrior. Warrior, who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor. Two arch enemies battle to the death. Thor, the thunder god, against a staggering beast. A giant snake who strikes with lethal force. It is man versus monster. Thor unleashes his deadliest weapon, lightning from his magic hammer, as thunder rocks heaven and earth. The myth of Thor is filled with these epic showdowns, heroic battles against creatures who threaten mankind.
Thor is the champion of the gods. He's the great fighter who can be brought out when something is really bad. You don't go to Thor for wisdom. Go to Thor because he's going to protect you against the evil monsters.
Tales of Thor's adventures provided escape from one of the bleakest periods in human history, the Dark Ages of the first millennium AD. It was a time when the Norse world, stretching from the British Isles to the Baltic Sea, was in turmoil.
It's an agricultural society where people were farming and surviving kind of at the very edge of how it was possible to survive because it was cold. It was the northern part of Europe. It wasn't around the Mediterranean where it was much easier to grow things. And it tended to be, from everything we can tell, quite violent.
War, famine, and death were daily facts of life on the desolate northern fringes of Europe. But the myth of Thor brought a sense of order to the chaos.
It was a religion of the countryside. Paganism actually is a Latin word that describes that, what the country people believe in. And paganism is not really well organized either. It's not like the Greek pantheon in the sense that it's very well organized and everybody knows whose responsibilities and who's more important than whom. It's very different.
The view of human life in that mythology was a fairly dark, a fairly stern one. Human beings didn't look forward to the kind of salvation in heaven at the end of time that's promised in the Christian stories. They had a kind of a darker, a more sorrowful view of life. People have to show great courage and hardiness in the face of enormous obstacles.
For inspiration, the people looked to Thor.
Boy, that Thor boy was a mean motor scooter. Terrible time of year, and it's the 6th of July, and finally the fireworks are beginning to calm down around here, and that's a good sign. And don't forget the address to send your big, big, big donations to, and that is Tom Metzger. Simple as that. 315, no, I won't do that. P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, California, 92583. You don't need that street address on there anymore. And I'll be waiting right there at that P.O. Box for that giant amount of money come rolling in here, or at least a little bit. Try to get it in earlier in the month, before the 20th. Yeah. Even before that, if you can. And several of you are quite prompt at that, getting it in quite early. Some of them even get them in here on the last day of the other month. Yeah. I see General Townsend, whoever he is up there in Washington, has said that, even after we get peace in Syria, we're still going to be there for a long time. Of course, we have to police it for Israel. The whole thing, all the mix-up is, and all the mistakes and screw-ups is because of our involvement with Israel. Israel never knows exactly what it wants, other than to screw other people. So they are, they want Iran. That's their big plum. They just got to get something going with Iran, and the only way they can get it going is to use the U.S. and the State Department. So the State Department can't get anything done because they're filtering all their orders through the State of Israel. And so that's why it's all so screwed up. I sent you that video show today, that this morning, that talked about that. That's why our foreign policy is so screwed up. And now they got Trump in there, and he's I can't believe it. It's going to be funnier than hell. But it's not going to be funny to the people who have to go over there and fight for these bastards. Fight for Saudi Arabia, the one that knocked down the Twin Towers. Now they're our best buddy. I thought Trump was a patriot. I thought that he was the great white father, the patriot. But here he is, almost French kissing and getting down on his knees to these Saudi bastards. Yeah, how about that? Jumping right into all these squabbles between these countries. Wow. Now he wants to give Qatar trouble. As far as I know, Qatar was just a banking spot and not that big a population. It was pretty peaceful. I don't think they got any armies over there. But we got the 7th Fleet there, I'll tell you that. How's that going to work? They start throwing missiles at Qatar and hit our own ships. Things couldn't be more screwed up and chaotic, and we like chaotic because it weakens the system. Yeah, I like that. If the system is strong, you, my friend, are weak. And I'd rather you be strong and the system be weak. Well, I see the right wing's at it again. The KKK of the right wing. With Saturday's Ku Klux Klan rally at Justice Park approaching, former KKK Imperial Wizard David Duke is urging his Twitter followers to attend another event set for next month in Charlottesville. Duke on Wednesday night tweeted a photo of a flyer for the Unite the Right event on August 12th at Emancipation Park. Emancipation Park, that's a terrible place to have a Klan meeting. Commenting, "Be there, the fake news will be." That's what he said. Unite the Right. Well, I think the Unite's pretty well united, and you're not part of it, really. You think you are. A permit for the event obtained by the local right-wing blogger and activist Jason Kessler estimates that there will be about 400 people gathered at the former Lee Park, that they changed the name to Emancipation Park, from 12 to 5 p.m. I would not meet in a park with that name myself. Kessler was one of the more than 100 people who gathered in Lee Park on May 3rd for a torchlight rally led by white nationalist Richard Spencer and others in response to the city's decision to rename the park and remove the statue of General Robert A. Lee because he screwed up the Battle of Gettysburg. Oh, no. The event is taking shape as a gathering of far-right political activists and white nationalists. I thought they were white supremacists and white racists. Well, I guess not. So, anyhow, Duke will be able to refurbish his mailing list, and all these new people going to show up, going to be on the naughty list. That's all it's about. But if they're new, they're naive and don't know the way the game is played and don't know how this song and pony goes, show goes. But I've been at it too long. I've told them, warned them too long. I'm not going to warn them anymore. They're going to have to learn. If you don't listen, you'll have to feel, boys. And go out there and wave your flag and wear your T-shirt and yell white power and just have lots of fun. Place on here this thing about a gathering of far-right political activists and white nationalists. Far-right political activists. Well, I thought that's what was in the White House now. Well, maybe Trump will come out there and be with the boys. This newspaper must like Mr. Duke, the Dukester, plastic man. They put a picture of him up that's about 35 years old before he butchered himself with plastic surgery. Well, the Great White Father's in a fix now. Ivanka Trump on Thursday visited the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial a day after Polish Jews condemned her father, U.S. President Donald Trump, for leaving the monument off his to-do list while in the Polish capital. Yeah, you got to give reverence and pray to those Jews, man. If you don't, you're in big trouble. The 35-year-old businesswoman and Trump advisor, who converted to Judaism before marrying a grandson of Holocaust survivors, laid flowers with the message from the United States and recited a Kaddish prayer with Poland's chief rabbi, Michael Sierdrzysz, at the monument dedicated to the victims or the whatever of the 1943 Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Well, that's just not good enough. Donald, you gotta be there and kiss their ass real good. You can't get away with that stuff, just sending your daughter. Can't get away with that. We'll remember that. Sierdrzysz, the rabbi, called Ivanka's presence at the memorial very, very important. Not only because she's a Jew, because her grandparents-in-law are survivors of the whole H-word, but also as a human being, it's important, unquote. Quote, but it's sad because her father, President Trump, is the first U.S. president in 25 years not to visit the Warsaw Ghetto Heroes Monument. Wow, you're in big trouble now, Mr. Trump. Sierdrzysz released a joint statement with other Jewish community leaders on Wednesday saying, they deeply regret that President Donald Trump, though speaking in public barely a mile away from the monument, chose to break with the laudable tradition alongside so many others. We trust that his slight does not reflect the attitudes and feelings of the anti-Semitic American people, said the statement co-signed by Leslaw Pizaski, President of the Union of Jewish Communities of Poland and Jewish Community of Warsaw President Anna Chłopopowski. Poland spokesman Janata Janowski told AFP that the museum only found out today that Ivana Trump would be visiting the monument dedicated to the Jewish partisans who took up arms against German forces in a doomed revolt. There you go. Boy, they're in trouble now. You know the difference between, one of the differences between Israel and England? An important difference. Civilians can keep firearms in Israel, something they are permitted to do after national service. They usually have to serve about 2 years, I think. There has been a number of cases where those taking part in attacks have been shot dead by passersby by carrying guns. Israeli Defense Force Counterterrorism Training Center has numerous recordings of this type of lethal public intervention. The center's commander, who did not want his identity publicized, was also in view that 8 minutes was a long time before an attack is stopped. So, I guess it's okay to have guns over there in Israel and shoot bad guys, or alleged bad guys, but not in England. I wonder why American liberals don't take the same position that alleged bad guys should be shot by people carrying guns on the street. Because Jewish liberalism and conservatism, they're all mixed up and different and screwed up. That's why. They are pragmatists. They use whatever plan works wherever they're at. And that's smart. So the Jew guy in Israel says we have more than 30,000 members of the public who can carry firearms. They are trained during national service, and obviously that is a very useful resource to have when dealing with street attacks, since we have started facing this threat. I know when I was over there, people were standing around in front of hotels and every place else with AK-47s and AR-15s right out there where you could see it. A lot of them had 9mm too. Hey boys and girls, you want to know about the crime in your neighborhood? Well, they got a new service. It's called www.neighborhoodsscout.com. That's www.neighborhoodsscout.com. You can find out who the bad boys are in your neighborhood. You'll probably be on the list. Well, Chicago Black Ku Klux Klan totals. 3 men were killed and at least 14 other people were wounded in shootings Tuesday across Chicago, including 5 people, and I didn't catch that.
The CBS 2 Broadcast Center, meteorologist Steve Baskerville here with the Weather Watch forecast. And Steve, another...
Sorry, Stevie, I didn't want to hear about the weather. I wanted to hear about the Black KKK in Chicago, but it's not on there, so goodbye. Well, let's get back into the, what are we getting back into here? I know, letters from the front. How about that? We're going to start off this time with Canadian Letters, Chapter 3. Sapper G.W. Connell of Digby, writing to the Digby Weekly Courier, supplies an interesting account of the arrival of the first... Oh, just a minute, I got a problem. Silence. Supplies an interesting account of the arrival of the first contingent in England. He writes in part as follows, quote, "The papers called the contingent the bulwarks of old England without waiting to see whether they are or not. Still a little taffy goes a long way once in a while, you know. However, they are sincerely grateful to Canada for her assistance, and the people take every opportunity to show their goodwill. The papers are full of the doings of the Canadians. The English soldiers or Tommies get several shillings a day less than the Canadian, and you know how a Canadian spends his money. The people cannot get over it. The canteen men cannot seem to realize what quantity they must buy to keep in stock. Why, they fairly stood aghast for the first few days. Everyone who can afford it takes a trip out to camp in one of the big cars and that hold about 30, and the boys along the road get fairly showered with packages of cigarettes and sweet chocolate. All a fellow has to do is to let out that he's Canadian and he gets treated like a prince. We had a beautiful trip over. The weather was fine. Very little swell was going. There was only one day that was at all bad, and the night of that same day I woke up to find myself hanging onto the side of the bunk with the ceiling to one side and me instead of the overhead. I soon returned to my place again without any effort on my part. However, and it just took a week to get them dry by washing. Whoops, I think I missed something here. I think I'm going to skip this stuff here because this is sort of mundane. This is a dash for the coast. What Tommy Atkins said and did when he heard that the German plan was to hack a road to Calais in the readiness for an attempt to invade England is graphically described by a private in the Somersetshire LI who is now wounded and in hospital in Dublin. In a letter to his wife, he says, "I managed to have a bit of bad luck in being knocked over. But there is one consolation. It was not serious. The regiment had fought its way from the Amarantes to the place called Lewes, and there was nothing much to mention in this lot. I managed to get asleep that night, but I haven't had any since until I got into the hospital. The next 4 days we were doing nothing but bayonet charging the Germans out of the trenches, and you would laugh to see them run. As soon as we got within 300 yards of them, they would run, squealing like lots of pigs, shouting, 'There are the English devils,' falling over one another. Our regiment took a good number of prisoners. They seemed to be glad to be on their hands, but they won't believe that they are being defeated." I read another book once. I forget what the name of the book was. It showed that the mistake the Germans made in the First World War, they told their troops, brainwashed them, that the British were pushovers and sissies, and they couldn't fight. And then when the Germans got over there and started to fight them, they found out much different. The Brits were tough as hell. On Sunday, we marched to a place just this side of the Belgian frontier, and we ran into the main army of Germans. Then, of course, we had to have it. We were just cooking our bacon and breakfast at 4:30 a.m., and suddenly we were called to arms, which we did very quick. I lost my bacon and a canteen of water, which had just started to boil. I said a few words. You would not have understood them. This is not the first time I have lost my breakfast. We marched a matter of 5 miles when we came in touch with the enemy. And we were told that we had come across the famous, or rather the scrap iron army of von Kluck. Then, of course, it was a proper set to, and the sights we saw, you would never believe what we saw. We were in action from 7 o'clock in the morning till 5 at night, and I was pulling my trigger and taking steady aim until my arms and eyes fairly ached. The more we did shoot, the more came on, but in the finish, they got fed up and seeing their dead and wounded and our coolness. We had to stick it because we were told that this army was trying to get to Calais for the purpose of invading England. We all laughed at the idea. Most of the regiment said, "We'll give them Calais." And as to getting to England, what would the women be doing? Nothing, I don't think. At 10 o'clock, we had to dig ourselves in, and no sooner had we started when some more Germans started sniping at us. We took no notice, and a large body came up and drove us back a half a mile, but it took them 8 hours to drive us a half a mile. At 6 in the morning, we started to attack again and got on all right. Of course, you must remember that some of our fellows were hit over, but we covered 5 miles, then a short rest, and finished up with a bayonet charge. It's proper sport. It's proper sport, like running after a drove of rabbits. They don't know where to get out of the way of the bayonets, squealing, "Here's the Englander, that's us." We were glad when nightfall came, but that wasn't any good to us because we had to start digging again. At 1 o'clock, they started in the same old thing again, and this time drove us back for a couple of miles. No sleep again. We went on like this for 4 days, picking up the ground at daytime, losing a bit at night. The reason for this was to keep them from getting into positions so as to catch them on the run next day. This we enjoyed, but it made us dead tired, though. The new gag is Von Kluck, Von Kluck, owing to these attacks starting at 1 o'clock. We were ordered to take a little village, and we started off through thick wood and got into the village. We saw a couple of Uhlans and soon routed them. Then the noise of the rifles going off started the thing all right. All of a sudden the doors opened on the houses and barns and you saw them come out, some doing somersaults out the windows. We stood with bayonets fixed and shot them down. They hoisted a white flag 3 times, but we took no notice. I suppose you know why, owing to treachery. We don't have any of that business now. The street was lined with German dead in heaps outside the doorways. I counted 10 in one heap, all laid on top of another. 20 of us got told off to search the houses for more Germans. Every house was turned upside down, and they had taken anything they could lay their hands on. We found 60 Germans huddled in a hayloft. How they did it, I don't know. We took them to headquarters after routing them out with a bayonet. Just as we got to the edge of the woods with these blokes from the village, a shrapnel burst. I was hit, my rifle went one way, me another. When I stood up, I shall never forget the sight. The shell must have burst right among this lot. It killed 10 Germans and wounded 20, killed 6 of our fellows and wounded 10. There was only 6 sound ones left. I touched lucky. My lot was only a shrapnel bullet in my left forearm and at one side and out the other. Then it went into my left foot, just below the little toe. I'm going to have the bullet extracted tomorrow, so that's all right. I can't say why they sent me here. They say the hospitals are full in England. I felt upset about this. I long to see you, old girl, and the baby and the mother. The Germans started shelling us again. Down went the officer, fine officer too. 3 other men went west. That left 2 of us who could manage to crawl along. The other fellow was wounded in the thigh. When we started crawling, you would have laughed to have seen us. There was me doing a side stroke on my right side, and there was White Knob, we call him that because his hair is lily white, crawling along on his stomach. I said to him, "Come on, old cock, I shall whack you in the quarter-mile swim," and he said, "No, you don't, slugger boy," and they were dropping shells all around us. When we got to a lane, I said I would try to stand up. I got my feet and found that I could not stand because I had gone quite dead from my arm and foot. I said we had better start swimming again. He said, "Hi, hi." We crawled through the thick wood for about 1,000 yards when suddenly Smith fainted away and lay that still. I thought this time his time had come. None of us had any water, and I was in a pickle because I had only one hand. I shouted and nobody came. Then Whitcomb came around again, and he said he could not stir as he had lost so much blood. I said I felt sure I should find our artillery and went crawling on. Heaven knows what my thoughts were. How long I crawled, I don't know. Then suddenly a gun belonging to our quick firers went off and very nearly drove me off. On my right, I saw a 4.7 under the cover of leaves. I got within 50 yards, and one of the gunners saw me and came across with his bayonet fixed. When he saw who I was, he carried me across behind the gun. The officer sent some men, and they fetched Smith in. One of the battery tore the sleeve off my coat and tied it around my arm, and I waited like that for 3 till 10 a.m. or 10 at night. New French writers of the present day have a more sympathetic body of admirers in England than the distinguished naval officer and brilliant accommodation who hides his personality under the familiar pen name Pierre Loti. Like so many more eminent literary Frenchmen, he has been fascinated by the war, and in a letter to a French newspaper, he gives a charming account of the recent visit, October 1914, to the French and British troops, where he appears to have been especially captivated with the manly attributes of Les Escassiers. In this case, probably either Gordon Highlanders or Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. It was about 11 o'clock in the afternoon, he says, when I arrived in a village in northeast France. I'm not allowed to recall its name. I was accompanied by an English commandant, whom the chance of war had given me as a companion since the previous evening, and we were very politely accompanied by a great magician, namely the sun, a radiant sun, a glorious sun, transforming the embellishing everything. All this took place in a department of the extreme north of France. In order to get there, we had been 2 hours hemmed in between two files of soldiers marching in opposite directions. On our right were the British regiments proceeding to the front, smart and fresh, with a well-content and confident air about them, splendidly equipped with handsome, sleek horses. On our left were the French artillerymen on their way back from the gigantic battle in order to get a little repose. They were dusty and unkempt, with here and there bandages on their arms or around their heads, but all in excellent spirit and marching in good order by sections. In the distance, you could hear what sounded like a distant thunderstorm, at first dull and indistinct, but getting nearer and clearer. In the fields round about, the farm hands were going on with their ordinary work, as if nothing unusual were happening, but not quite sure all the same whether the savages who were making such a racket out towards the horizon would not be coming back some day to harry them. Scattered about here and there in all directions around about these little fires made of twigs were pathetic groups which would have been lamentable under a gloomy sky, but which a lovely late autumn sun of the day was able to infuse with a little gaiety. There were refugees, immigrants, fleeing in terror before the German Huns, doing their precocious cooking and their gypsy fashion in the midst of shabby and untidy bundles of humble belongings which they had flung together anyhow in haste when the terrible cry, "Les Boches," sounded in their ear, "The Germans are coming." Our motor car was filled with packages of cigarettes and newspapers which some kind-hearted souls had asked us to convey to the men in the firing line. And so closely were we shut in between the two marching lines that we could distribute them only through the windows, to the English on the right, to the French on the left. They stretched out their hands to snatch them hurriedly, smiling and thanking us by a rapid military salute. There were also villagers who were traveling, mixed up with the soldiers along the high road so painfully overcrowded. I recalled a young and very pretty country girl who, between two English transport wagons, was pulling a string, two babies asleep in a little homemade cart. It was as much as she could do to keep up. There was a steep incline at the place. A handsome Scottish sergeant with golden yellow mustache was smoking a cigarette, his legs dangling behind the nearest wagon. He made a gesture as much to say, "Pass me at the end of your rope." the girl understood and accepted the offer with a polite but modest smile. The gallant Scot wound his frail two-rope around his left arm, keeping his right arm free to go on with his smoking, and it was he who thus guided to safety the two babies of France, whose little cart was dragging behind the heavy transport car like a feather. When we entered the village, the sun shone out with more and more splendor. There was to be seen there a mixture of nationalities such as has never been seen before, and probably never will be seen again after this war, which is destined to be unique in history. There were all sorts of uniforms, all sorts of arms, kilted Scots, French cuirassiers, Turcos, Zouaves, as well as Bedouins, who, by the way of military salute, lifted their bernals with a noble gesture. The open square in front of the church was crammed full of enormous English motor buses, which had not so long ago plied in London streets, and indeed still bore huge letters and names of the different districts of the English metropolis. I'm going to cut this now and do something else. You know, this is this First World War and how crappily it was fought. It seems like the Germans took the worst of it. It was one of the reasons why, evidently, Hitler was so pissed off that they had been betrayed when they surrendered. And I can see why. I mean, these guys fell by the thousands in trench warfare of the worst type. And then their leaders abandoned them. No wonder Hitler was so pissed. Would you be pissed? Yeah. Well, I got a note from one of our boys back east. It says things are changing fast. My area is being rebuilt by affluent homosexual latrinos, then more in. A better lot taken than the niggers. Sound war has begun. I tested a 300-watt loudspeaker and this combo worked quite well to give my adversaries trouble. I found a 38-inch loudspeaker at the swap meet from 1943. The speaker was on a Navy ship. I paid $20 for it. I use it for psychological propaganda, playing through my big speakers. I've had to do that a few times myself, my friend. Like on 4th of July, I'd like to have one of those big berthas they used over in Europe in World War I. They'd shoot about 20 miles. And load it up with blanks, and when they do all those fireworks and pull a cord on that thing, it would have shook the ground all over Southern California. You know, I just uncarted a big box of old shows, audio, cassette shows from a long time ago. I must have 100 of them in there. I have no idea where all these came from. But I know there's a lot of good stuff in there, so I'm going to play one back today that was with my good buddy, Wally George. You remember Wally George? A lot of you guys probably still remember Wally George. Here we go.
To our VIP hotline, and are you there, Metzger?
I sure am, Wally, you old conservative, you.
Oh, shut up. Now, on the VIP line is this horrifying rodent that you have seen on my nationally syndicated television show. He is the former, in case you didn't know, the former Grand Dragon of the dreaded Ku Klux Klan. He now has his own organization called WAR, W-A-R, the White Aryan Resistance Movement.
Right, Box 65, Fallbrook, California.
Never mind the plugs. Now, you are on the show today because I haven't talked to you for some time, and I wanted to know, are you still running that racist organization, WAR?
The racist organization is growing by leaps and bounds. We're publishing a newspaper every month, a full-size tabloid. We're in 50 cities around the country with our television show, and we're just going through the roof, Wally.
Yeah, because you are appealing to perverted racists like yourself. As I have said so many times on my TV show, Tom, you are a disgrace to America because, you know, we have had so many problems with racism, bigotry, and all that kind of thing with you and the Nazi Party and all that. And I think, I have long thought that people like you should be put under lock and key because what you have been doing, Metzger, and you know you have, for the majority of your adult life, what you have been doing, you have been spreading hatred and racism all across this great land, pitting white against black.
Wally, slow down, slow down.
You can answer. You have been trying to convince the majority that whites are superior to blacks. You want to segregate this nation. And I say you are a disgrace to the United States of America.
Well, number one, I'm trying to wake up the people of this country of what a crooked, rotten criminal system, government they have now. You've been supporting, you're one of those conservatives, you supported Bush and Reagan.
Of course I did.
Yeah, the same guys that now that are sending all this food over to Somaliland and all these troops over supposedly to feed the poor black people.
That's right.
But we all know, according to the LA Times last week, that it's all about oil. Millions and millions of acres, miles of land over there is now owned by the oil companies, Sunoco, Amoco, Phillips, and Exxon, and they're going to move in there after we take care of all the taxpayers to clean out the situation for them.
Oh, by the way,
you see, that's your conservatives, your conservative fat cats. You want to draw the attention away from us white racial separatists. You want to put it on us and draw the attention away from your crooked, corrupt, greedy conservative friends.
Let me tell you this, Metzger. You do not talk about white Americans, whether you want to believe it or not. I've said this before to you, and I'll say it again. We are all Americans, no matter what color we may be. We are all equal. We are all equal Americans with the same rights, no matter if you're white or black or yellow or brown. We are equal Americans, and you will never understand that.
I thought you weren't a Marxist. Well, you got rid of the economic Marxism to a degree, but now you're still hanging on to racial Marxism. Racial Marxism, that's the number one plank. Everybody's equal. Nobody's better, higher on the totem pole than anybody else. We all just equal slaves. That's what we are. And that's racial Marxism. And Wally, you're supposed to be against Marxism.
We're not talking about Marxism, Metzger.
That's the main plank in Marxism. Everyone's equal and all that nonsense.
Oh, you're talking about Marxism, communism, where everyone gets the same amount of money, et cetera, et cetera. That is not good at all what I'm...
Read what Marx said about race. And read what the Soviet Union's laws were on race.
We're not talking about
that's
Marxism.
Exactly what they're trying to enforce here. And you conservatives are the Trojan horse, bring it in, you know?
Don't you know the United States of America was created to be a melting pot for people from all over the world to come here and have equal rights, have the same rights to succeed, to get ahead, and just because you happen to be black does not mean that you do not have the same rights to progress and succeed as if you were white.
But people came here for all kinds of reasons. People came here for greed, to carve out empires. They came here to create slavery. They came here to do all kinds of things, to create kingdoms.
What I'm saying, you refuse to accept what I'm saying is in America, this is one nation under God with liberty and justice for all. No matter what color you may be, you have the same justice. We are all equal in America.
And at this late date, if you believe that, you believe in the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, and a lot of other nonsense that the big shots and the people in power feed the poor working people of this country who are becoming slaves very fast. The rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer, and you help feed this nonsense to the poor working people of all races.
You don't believe in equality because you think that the whites are superior to the blacks and that the whites should always have one up on the blacks. They should get the jobs before the blacks do. And this is something that we cannot tolerate anymore in the United States of America. Now, you went to jail up in Canada for practicing your racist tactics. By the way, some of you may not recall this, but some followers and supporters of Tom Metzger not long ago went up to Oregon, and they found a black man, and they beat him to death with baseball bats. And, of course, that was Metzger-inspired, because that's what the Metzger clan likes to do. They like to kill blacks and other minorities. They hate blacks and Jews and all other minorities.
Well, let me take this in its order here. As far as Canada is concerned, it's interesting you bring that up, because I'm catching a plane right after I talk to you, and I shouldn't even have stuck around to talk to you, and I'm going to Canada. They've said, threatened they'll put me in jail in Vancouver if I come across the border. They say they're going to slap me in jail for 2 years, and I say,
don't do that.
And I say, catch me if you can. I'll cross your border anytime I'm damn good and ready, and there's nothing you're going to do about it.
They threw you in jail in Canada the last time because you went across the border and you lied to the border guard.
Absolutely.
They asked you what you were doing there, and you said you were there to do a little bit of shopping.
Absolutely not.
Actually, you were there to conduct some racist hate rally.
Absolutely not. I did not say I was in Buffalo to shop. They asked me what we were doing in Buffalo, and I didn't even answer. The people driving the car said they were there to shop. I didn't say that. I had a passport. I answered the questions the man asked, and I was put in jail in Canada purely because they didn't like my speech that I gave to 300 young people that are coming and around our banner every day, more and more young people, and they never charged me with a crime in Canada.
Well, what did they throw you in jail for then?
Because they have a silly law up there which says they could throw you in jail on an administrative charge coming across the border for almost any reason at all.
They threw you in jail, Tom, because you were conducting undesirable racist activities in their country.
I came across that border in broad daylight with a valid U.S. passport, and I played their game that time, but from now on I'll play it my way. I'll get across the border. I played it their way. Now we'll play it the Metzger way, and I'll go up to Canada anytime I want.
Well, the Metzger way here in the United States of America is to spread hatred for blacks in America and Jews. And that's what
the Metzger way is, to spread the good news of working for the white race. And the white race is definitely has a problem worldwide. We are 12% of the world population and dropping, but yet we seem to care about every other race but our own. My main job is to work for the white race. Now, if that brings any other race into a problem with me for doing that, then we'll just have to face that.
You should not, as an American, be singling out any race. We are all Americans. I would like to do away with the hyphenated American. There should be no black Americans, white Americans, Asian Americans, Chinese Americans, whatever. We are all Americans, Tom, and you should not, as a good American citizen, be working for the white race. You should be working for all of the people, to help all of the people in this country, no matter what color they may be.
The white race got what they've got. They conquered. They took over. They took what they needed. They built a great Western civilization. And we are not about, hopefully, to let the non-white third world masses, who can't even seem to feed themselves in Africa, to take over our civilization. And that's what we're fighting for, and that's it. And
are you opposing us, what we're doing right now to help these poor, starving blacks over there?
Absolutely, because you're interfering with Mother Nature. Nature says if you're too stupid to walk and go someplace where you can plant something or even revert to cannibalism to survive, then you're stupid, and then nature weeds you out. When you feed them, they're simply...
So you're saying, Tom, this is unbelievable, you're saying that the blacks who are starving over there and that we're trying to help are starving because they're stupid.
That's right. They're stupid, and they don't have enough brains to migrate somewhere where they can get food or do whatever it takes to get food. The only smart ones in Somaliland are the leaders of the clans.
The
leaders of the clans, they know what they want, they take it, and they're probably living pretty good.
The reason so many of the Somalis are starving to death, women and children and the like, is because of the corruption over there. That is why they're starving, not because they are stupid.
Well, every black country in Africa is corrupt. You think there's any parallel there? They're all corrupt. They're all unable to support themselves.
All the blacks are stupid and corrupt, in your opinion.
When left into their own condition, if you leave a purely black system, a purely black government, it'll fall, it'll degenerate, and it'll go down to nothing. That's simply the way it is. The Negroes should be thrilled to death and kiss the ground they're on here in the United States to be close to white people.
You are without a doubt. The more you speak, the more my stomach churns.
One thing I think is really interesting, we really got a good guy in the White House now with Mr. Clinton, because...
You support Clinton?
Well, he's the first president we've had that I know of with a mulatto, a black child, born of a prostitute by the name of Bobby Ann Williams down in Little Rock.
What are you talking about?
There's going to be a big book come out in the spring by George Carposi that will detail his whole sordid lifestyle with many women, and one of which is a black prostitute, Bobby Ann Williams from Little Rock.
I am no fan.
His name is Danny, and I've got a picture of him right in front of me.
Now, wait a minute.
And he looks just like Clinton.
Wait a minute, Master. I am no fan of Bill Clinton, as all of my listeners and viewers know. I am not happy that he's president, but I will not have you go on the air and malign him by saying he has an illegitimate black child.
Well, if you were a real reporter, unlike this amateur conservative stuff, you would have known about George Carposi's new book coming out in the spring. It's not on the stand yet, but you can get in touch with him, get him on your show.
Credible is he?
I don't know, but get him on the show and find out.
If you don't know how credible he is, why are you saying then that this is a fact, that Clinton has a black a child? Somewhere?
Because I've got a picture of this mulatto kid.
Got a picture. That doesn't mean
I got a picture of the kid. He looks just like Clinton, only he's dark.
You are so ridiculous.
Resistance weekend news update. To the superstitious in Israel, the new Jewish year points to the Day of Judgment. Jewish columnist Amos Kinnan said, "There is a hidden link between the peace of Israel and the peace of the world. There is a link between the blood spilled in Lebanon and the blood spilled in Afghanistan, in the skies over Sakhalin Island, in Chad and Sri Lanka." End of quote. In all those places, the people are fighting communism. The link between Israel and communism is a lot more obvious than Amos Kinnan thinks. Tear gas classes are being offered by the Office of Community Relations at Fullerton College, 321 East Chapman Avenue, on October 8th, November 5th, and December 3rd in room 725-A of the Technical Education Building. They'll be holding those classes. I don't know the fee, but I believe that there is one. Education Secretary T.H. Bell said, "There's more than 100 historically black colleges. They are receiving an 11.5% increase in funds, giving them $629 million in aid to black colleges. There so far is no money allocated to integrate those black colleges. However, there is money to integrate elementary schools around the nation." Jesse Jackson will be here in Orange County, 1 p.m. Saturday at Santa Ana Valley High School. Jackson is president of PUSH, a Chicago-based civil rights group who are accused of using $1.7 million in ways contrary to federal laws. This is White American Resistance, Post Office Box 65, Fallbrook, California, 92028. A A Study of Racial Hybridity by Philip Jones is a well-documented book that describes the effects of race mixing. He says that the majority of Christians mistakenly believe that faith magically enables anyone, regardless of race, to understand the difference between right and wrong independently from the reasoning faculty. However, man works as a single unit, and not as a body at one time, a mind at another, and a spirit at still another time. We think with our bodies as well as our minds, and the spirit influences the thought life as well. He states the inequalities among human beings are mainly dependent upon the hereditary equipment, and this cannot be transformed in any simple way, either by material or by spiritual influences. As the Negro male sees himself as having vanquished the white man in the field of love, and of having rendered him impotent and castrated, in effect killing him by planting his own seed rather than the white man's. Eldridge Cleaver, the famous black homosexual, corroborates this feeling in his book, Soul on Ice, where he defiled many white women because of his hatred for the white man. The black man has an opportunity to live out murderous fantasies of revenge. In possessing the white woman, he sees himself as degrading her. So buy this book, Racial Hybridity, and write us, White American Resistance, Post Office Box 65, Fallbrook, California, 92028.
I've got all these tapes, and I thought a lot of them were lost. But I've managed to hang on to a certain number of them, maybe 100 of them. And I'm going to play you tomorrow back a scam I pulled on the Canadians. Of course, after I was arrested, John and I, my son, and we got out of that mess and got back to Fallbrook, back home, then we set up another program, and this was where we were going to infiltrate British Columbia and give a speech at a big hotel up there. And the funny part about it was we weren't going to go there at all, but we were going to make it look like we were, and the Canadian Mounted Police and all those people were going to get us, and they were going to make sure we didn't get in. And we concocted a plan, and Dennis Mahon helped with that. He went in through Ontario, and I went in through British Columbia, or I supposedly did. So tomorrow I'll play that back. I'm not exactly sure how much of that footage I've got. It was one of the funniest things we ever did. The Reds, which they were the Reds up there in Canada, they vowed that there was no way that Tom Metzger was going to give a speech in that hotel, and they were prepared to tear down and burn down the hotel to keep me out. So I'll play it for you tomorrow. That's it for today. I'll see you Freya's Day, okay?
Cheer up, man. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. forget about your scene. Give the audience a grin. Enjoy it. It's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
I'm trying to get up.
Always look on the right side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
First thing that we see, you know. Nothing will come from nothing, you know what I say?
Oh,
you
old bugger.
Come on, give us a grin.
There you are.
See? In the film. Incidentally, this record's available in the foyer.
Always look on the right.
Summer's got a little
song.
What do you think pays for this rubbish?
Always look on the money back, you know?
I told him. I said to him, Bernie, I said, I'll never make that money back.